Coping with a traumatic death is one of the hardest challenges anyone can face. On today's podcast, Sarah Canning eloquently explains how she remains positive following the death of her partner, Lyra McKee, by encouraging and empowering young people to have a meaningful lives. Sarah, welcome to Memory Me Podcast. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you?
Not too bad. Good. Well, it could be better than a wee bit of a kidney infection, but here we are. We're rocking, we're rolling. Sarah, just give us a wee bit of a background of like who you are and where you come from.
Okay, so I'm Sarah Canning. I'm a Derry girl.
Yeah.
Born and raised, So I've always, pretty much always lived in Derry. I lived away for a wee while. Came home in 2010 after 5 years in England because I hated it.
Yeah.
And
were you uni or?
No, I was actually, my mommy died in 2005.
Okay.
And she had a really, like, quite an aggressive type of lung cancer.
Yeah.
So we lost her a year to the day from her diagnosis, pretty much.
Oh my God.
And during that time, just everything, like your entire life changes, as you
yeah,
know,
absolutely.
When you lose somebody,
absolutely,
whether it's sudden or not. And I had been kind of thrust on a bit of a caring role for my dad, and then my sister was doing all of the heavy lifting by my mommy. She was taking her up and down to her treatment in Belfast, so I was kind of helping my sister's husband look after their kids and stuff like that.
God, that must have been a big impact these two as
well. I was only like 20, going under 21.
Okay.
And it kind of told me a lot of about the fact that I definitely didn't want children. And then when my mommy died, my daddy was kind of one of these helpless men. He was a typical dairy man of his generation. He had a woman to look after him from cradle to grave, near enough.
Yeah.
And I was being put under that role of, you need to look after your daddy now. And I was like, I'm not old enough to do this. So I'd met a man.
Yeah.
And he lived in England when we met on the internet. And I ended up moving to England to be with him.
Yeah.
So I was there for 5 years, hated all of it.
Yeah.
But I think it was the best thing for me to do to kind of cement who I was and what I wanted for my life.
Yeah.
So I came back to Derry, and when I came back, I came out because I knew I'd realised I was gay while I was away.
Yeah.
So people know me because my partner was Lyra McKee, who was murdered in 2019 in Craigan by the new IRA.
Yeah.
And I made a conscious choice the morning after to speak out because there were politicians there who were going to speak, and I was like, she would not have had that.
No.
And it wasn't going to be about Lyra then. It was going to be about politics, whereas actually the person I loved had been murdered and she was amazing. So I wanted to make sure that people would be thinking about her more so than Arlene Foster being in Craigan.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. What's the relationship with yourself and Lyra? How did you meet, and you know, how long were you together and stuff?
We actually, our relationship was quite short. We were only together for 13 months altogether.
Okay, right, yeah.
The day after St. Patrick's Day, 2018, I was lying, hanging like a bat.
As you do.
Currying my hair. I was not in a good place. I'd been very drunk the night before.
Yeah.
And I got a message from this account that I had interacted with previously, but we'd only liked each other. And she was saying, oh, and my thing at the time, I was a massive Harry Potter fan.
Yeah.
And she was like, if a mark of a true Harry Potter fan, do you know what your American house is? And I was like, even though I was lying there like, huh? I was like, of course I know what my American house is. I'm a Pukwudgie.
Uh-huh.
And it just started from there. So from that point until the moment she died, we didn't stop talking.
Yeah.
And we had 13 phenomenal months together.
Yeah.
You know, we did. And those 13 months, I think I loved more in those 13 months than I did in the 5 years I was in England.
Oh my God.
You know, the two of us, like my daddy died during that period of time. She had just signed a 2-book deal with Faber and Faber. Just everything was going from strength to strength.
Yeah.
And then that
night. And I suppose she was there for you to lean on to as well after the passing your daddy and stuff.
100%. I mean, we'd only been together. My daddy was terminally ill when we met, and that was one of the things I said to her. It's like, my time's going to be impacted because I'm taking him for treatments and back and forth to the hospital and stuff. But he was in hospital for 5 weeks before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And she came, every time that she came down from Belfast or up from Belfast, she came to the hospital and spent time with my daddy, and her and my daddy developed like a nice wee relationship.
Amazing.
It was really good because both of them, my daddy was really under the troubles as well because he was part of it.
Yeah.
And she was able to get information for him.
Yeah.
about things because she had great contacts
yeah.
through her work as a journalist. So yeah. they just went off into their own wee world.
Yeah.
And I could just leave them for half an hour and go get a cuppa or whatever.
Yeah. Amazing. So your relationship just really was going from strength to strength.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we'd discussed everything. You know, after my daddy died, like I spent a lot of time up in Belfast with her and her mommy because her mommy had a lot of chronic illnesses. She was an amputee. She had lupus, all this sort of stuff. She was going through the mill as well. And Lyra cared for her mommy in the same way I cared for my daddy. And we had made the decision to move in together. And we made the decision that we were definitely going to get married. We knew that was happening. So
In Derry? Were you still living in Derry?
We were based in Derry. So because I just said it was too much for me to move to Belfast.
Yeah.
So hot on the heels of my daddy dying.
Yeah.
All my family were there. My job was in the hospital, so I worked not in the Galvin as a phlebotomist, so I wasn't able to move about, whereas Lyra was freelance.
Yeah.
She could do her work anywhere, really.
Yeah.
And Derry was actually a good spot for her because there were loads of untapped resources that she'd never been into. So she was busy down interviewing ex-prisoners and you know, finding new contacts and all that sort of stuff when she moved here.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was going great.
Yeah. Right up until, there was the 18th April, wasn't it?
18th of April, yeah.
Actually, see that day, that the 18th of April, I actually lived in Fannet Drive. I moved out that day.
Oh my God.
I sold my house that day. Me and Berkey, we moved out that morning, the day that happened. Now, we were number 18, so we were down the bottom. Mm-hmm. We weren't right up at the scenes. But, do you know, there was a lot of commotion happening two nights previous to that as well, as you know. Do you know, and I remember leaving that day and the 18th saying, do you know, my God, I wonder what the night's going to be like, because the night before that there was a lot of commotion down down beside my end, because they were doing a lot of rioting down beside the chapel, which I loved opposite beside it. So it's hard to believe that on that same day that happened, we moved out that day.
I'm sure you're glad, because I know from other people, you know, like, I mean, I know the girl who loved one of the houses right beside where it happened, and she's got young kids that are, one of them's got, like, you know, additional needs and stuff, and, like, people having to deal with that level of violence on their doorstep, regardless of anybody being shot, because that's the last thing that any of us, I think, ever expected that night or any other. I mean, that's what I was saying that night when we were going up. I didn't want to go up.
No.
Because, I mean, you know what it's like. You live in Derry.
Yeah.
You experience riots from a young age. And I mean, I grew up just sort of on the cusp of the Bogside and the Brandywell. So as a Wayne, it was every weekend.
Yeah, 100%.
You know what I mean? Your entire summer, there was riots. So it didn't really hold any excitement for me.
No.
But for Lyra, she was brought up in Belfast, and she was Cliftonville. So like, she was pretty much in the thick of it as well.
Yeah.
But her family kept her really sheltered from it. So she had never actually experienced riots before. She'd never been to one. She'd never really seen one apart from maybe out the window. And she was really excited to go because I think she had her journalist head on.
Oh, 100%. Right. You know? So,
And this was young people rioting, because we'd seen the pictures were coming through and the footage and all the rest of it. And I think she was just thinking, right, you know, there's these kids who weren't even alive when the troubles happened.
Yeah.
And they're in the thick of this. What's happening?
Yeah.
You know, so she begged Kenna to go up, and she phoned our friend Sinead, and she was like, oh, Sinead didn't answer her phone.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, you tell people, you text and say, oh, I'm going up to these riots, and then just give me a call, and then you don't answer your phone. Come and get us.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, whatever, going up. I knew it was going to be, obviously there's always an element of danger.
Yeah.
But we went up and we had stood at the top of the street. And then we walked right down to where the bottom set of Land Rovers were, just before the tipper truck that was burning.
Okay.
And I said, there, no, it was making a lot of weird noises. I was like, we'll just head back up again, because I don't think it's going to explode. I don't think they actually do explode outside of films, but we'll just not take a chance.
Yeah.
So like, that was the only danger that I saw that night, was, you know, either being hit by something from, maybe if the car did go off, or a stone or a bottle, you know.
Yeah.
The things that, as a child, you would always have been really mindful of when you went to those events.
Yeah.
So, like, I thought we were doing all of
the right things.
The right things and being as safe as we possibly could by moving as far up the street.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you could.
And then it was them moments then that's when it happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were there for 8 minutes.
8 minutes altogether. 8 minutes
altogether. So I had rung my sister as I was coming from, is it Central Drive at the top?
Yes, that's right.
I was yeah. right in the corner at Central Drive, and I was ringing my sister and I was saying to her, oh my God, we're up this riot. Rolling my eyes, and yeah. she was like, well, just be careful. And I was like, no, we're going to be careful, we'll keep away from everything, like yeah. I was like, God, it's mad. I'll let you know the crack, I'll send you pictures. And then hung up the phone from my sister, and 8 minutes later she got another phone call from me screaming that Lyra had been hit in the head by something. I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I really wasn't sure what it was, like, because I was standing right beside her. And you know, you try to rationalize it because you're never going to think bullet straight
Absolutely.
Away.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I was thinking, I and had probably heard
because there's so much commotion happening there anyway. That's you it. Know,
you know, and you knew there were stones and bricks and bottles flying, and I knew that somewhere in the back of my head I had seen what I was thinking was fireworks.
Yeah.
But now I know it was the police letting off flares. Obviously, they do distress flares when anything happens.
Yeah.
And that's what it was that was on, that I was thinking about. So I sent a message onto my group of friends when we get under the car just saying, Lyra has been hit in the head by something. We're on our way to the hospital now. I don't know if it was a brick, a firework or a bullet.
Yeah.
And that was the first time that it came into my head because I was just like, I don't know.
What's...
What else could have caused the level of damage? Because I put my hand to her head
mm-hmm.
and I felt the damage that had been done
yeah.
to her skull.
Yeah.
And I knew how bad it was from that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what made me start thinking that it couldn't have been something like a brick.
Yeah.
Because I would have noticed that would have come yeah, past 100%. Me. I would have felt it.
Yeah.
You know, but it was just something that came out of nowhere and I had no reason to think
yeah.
that that's what it was. But at mm-hmm. the same time, I couldn't think of anything else that would have hurt her as badly.
Mm-hmm. And then did the ambulance service, did they come at the scenes then straight away?
No.
No?
So there's right. no way that the ambulance could have gotten there in time, just oh, with God. The fact that the roads were massively clogged that night. I mean, even coming from where I live in Bishop Street to Craigan took us ages because everybody was going up for a nosey.
Yeah, you know, 100%.
And, you know, I mean, for people that aren't from Derry, Central Drive's quite a narrow road.
Yeah.
And obviously they were all built before people would have had 2 or 3 cars a household.
Yeah.
So if you're thinking everybody parked outside their houses... leaves enough room for like maybe a car each way yeah. And it was clogged in both directions
yeah you we know. Were the same actually like the lead up for them 2-3 nights
mm.
we had no drive in Fannett Drive so we had to park our cars outside right. and ours was actually parked outside the chapel for 2 or 3 days beforehand because I just wouldn't take the chance of no. having my car outside
that's because you didn't you know what you was just didn't know
what was going to happen yeah
100% so what actually happened was I heard the crowd. There was a massive crowd down at the bottom and I heard them go, yo, really big loud. And I was like, something's going to happen. And my thought was, stupidly, I thought they're going to rush.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's a group of them going to rush towards. And I was like, I went to turn to Lyra to say, Lyra, we need to move because something's yeah. going to happen. And she wasn't there. And she'd been standing beside me a second before because I can't even remember. Like, wait, yeah. I'd said something there. And I looked down and she was on the ground. And she was kind of curled into the fetal position with her back against the Land Rover.
Mm-hmm.
And her glasses were on the ground and her phone was on the ground. And so I knew something was wrong. And then I looked at her face and she was so, so white. And then I saw the blood and I started screaming. And I put my hand to her head because obviously the first thing that you do when you see yeah. somebody bleeding yeah. is you put pressure on the wound.
Yeah.
But when I put my hand to her head, I knew that it was a really catastrophic, wasn't good, yeah. it was a catastrophic wound. And I think my screaming then had attracted all her people. And obviously, one of the things in areas like Craigan and any area where you have issues with the police, they do not trust the police.
Yeah.
So the cops opened the back of the Land Rover that she was lying against because I was bitten the side of it because it had started to move.
Oh, right. Okay.
And she was being kind of pulled. And that freaked me out because I was like, she's going to get pulled underneath that. And,
yeah.
you know, just all the things that go through your head. So a group of guys came over and they lifted her.
Okay.
And the police had opened the back of the Land Rover and they were going, put her in, we're going to check her. But the guys moved her away.
Okay.
So I was screaming at them. I was like, put her in the back of the Land Rover.
Yeah.
So they did. And I said, can I come? And they said, there's no room. There's her with her. We're going to have to work on her. And there's no room for you. Ring in 999. Tell them what's happened. and get yourself to the hospital. So I was standing in the middle of
Fanna Drive
with Lyra's glasses, her phone, which was ringing, and it was her mommy ringing her, my phone, covered in blood, my hands were covered in her blood, and I was just like, what do I do? And the Land Rover took off, and it went straight through the burning vehicles at the bottom of the street and tore off towards the hospital. I rang 999, which was kind of pointless, to be fair, because obviously I couldn't give them any real information, yeah, bar the police are taking her to the hospital.
Yeah.
And me and Sinead set off to her car.
Mm-hmm.
So I started ringing people. And her, as I said, like Lyra's phone was sitting in my hand, and yeah, it was her mommy ringing. And mm-hmm, I was like, I can't answer that, because yeah, her wee mommy just,
yeah,
you know, I didn't want to, I was really scared.
Yeah.
And I knew it was really bad, but I didn't want to be overreacting.
Yeah.
And telling her mommy.
Just yet, yeah.
I rang Lyra's big sister, Nicola, who would be like the sister she was closest to. And I was like, Nicola, something's happened to Lyra. We were at a riot. She's been hit in the head with something. I don't know what it is, but it's really bad. You need to get to Derry now.
Mm-hmm.
Get to Elton McGalvin. And she was like, oh, was it a stone? I was like, I don't know. But what I felt was really bad, get in the car,
mm-hmm,
and come now. And then I rang my sister and she was like, right, we're going straight to the hospital. So it actually took me longer to get out of Craigan.
Okay.
And get to the hospital, and it took my sister to get there.
Oh my God, almighty.
And she was coming from Skeg. It was just the traffic was that mental.
Chaos, yeah.
Absolutely chaotic. So it's one of those things, being from the area that I'm from,
yeah,
having trust in the police isn't a thing that you really do.
Yeah, 100%. You know? Yeah.
And I had to put my trust in them that night, and I've had to put my trust in them ever since. So like having to put my partner under the back of a Land Rover,
mm-hmm,
knowing how badly injured she was, not knowing, you know, what they could do, was a massive leap of faith. It was
absolutely
a really difficult
huge
thing to do.
Yeah.
They gave her the best chance at life that she,
yeah,
could have had.
And what was their moments like then going under the hospital?
Absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
When I got there, so Sinead just threw me off, and I ran up, you know, the wee entrance to A&E, she threw me off there and went to find parking, and I ran up and my sister was there waiting for me, and her partner was all finding parking, and I went down to the A&E reception, and I was covered in blood. It was on my face, it was all down my hands, and I was hysterical.
Yeah.
I was telling them, and they were, yeah, like, we have no record of her. And I was like, you have to have record of her.
Yeah.
She was brought in by the police, and at that, somebody came out of resus and, okay, came and got me. And it was a nurse who, I actually now, I love her. She was my central point that,
yeah,
night. She kept me grounded. And she came and got me, and she took me into the wee room, and she was like, listen, it's not looking good. She's been shot.
Yeah.
And that was kind of, it was like having everything that I was thinking in the car validated.
Yeah.
And I was saying it, but Sinead was trying to keep me calm. She was like, she hasn't been shot. This is just going to be a funny story about the time McKee fell over at,
yeah,
a riot and hit her head.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, Sinead, you don't even understand what,
yeah,
I felt.
Yeah.
You know? So she was like, right, tell me what her blood type is. Tell me who her next of kin is. Has she taken any medication today? So I thankfully knew that she had taken.
Yeah.
I'd given her a couple of painkillers, because when we had, that day we'd been to Slum and World, and then we went to McDonald's after it, as you always do. And on the way back, she was driving, and we were driving up the flyover, and she was nearly crying, and I was like, what's wrong? She was like, my arm's really killing me.
Yeah.
And I was like, right, you know what? Whenever we go in, go and get your jammies on,
yeah,
get cuddled up in bed. We just had decided we were going to spend the night listening to podcasts,
yeah,
and just like reading our books or whatever,
yeah,
and scrolling through Instagram.
Yeah.
I was like, go you on up to bed, get comfortable with a cat.
Yeah.
And I was also making his food. So I was like, I'm going to put the halloumi fries on, and we'll go and chill in bed with some halloumi fries. We'll listen to some crap podcasts, and we'll have a bit of crack. And then the messages started coming through, and that all went to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
So I was able to say, listen, I give her two ibuprofen,
yeah,
and you know her blood type, I'm pretty certain she was A positive. I was like, she's A positive and blah blah blah, so I could just see like the porters off running to the blood bank, and they were all guys because I work in the hospital, they're people,
yeah,
I know,
yeah,
who didn't recognize me because I was covered in blood,
yeah,
and
yeah.
So my sister was with me when that happened. We were like, oh my God. So she rang Nicola and said there, listen, she's been shot.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make sure you need to get here quicker. And then it wasn't very long after my friends started arriving, our friends, our group.
Yeah.
And then the doctor came out and said that it had been an unsurvivable wound. They had done everything they could. But unfortunately, Lyra hadn't survived it. So I fell to pieces. Absolutely. At that point. And my thing was, it was right now our sister and her mommy need to know.
Yeah.
Her family need to be made aware. So.
And they were probably the most hardest conversations you'll probably ever have.
Well, I didn't. Thankfully, I didn't have
you
to tell them.
You didn't have to.
It was my sister rang Nicola and then had passed her over to the police.
Okay.
And it was the police who actually broke the news.
Yeah.
I was incoherent at that time. I couldn't.
No, you couldn't. Yeah.
I couldn't speak. I was just like, the only thing I remember about that time is like I was sitting. I wasn't even crying.
Mm-hmm.
I was numb.
I was the same.
Aye. Just completely numb.
It's when you go through a traumatic loss like that, mm-hmm. unless you've actually walked them steps and went through that mm-hmm. that trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Then you know, you would know it. Like I was the same, like I was that numb, do you know.
Aye.
I had my friend, I actually passed out, but then they kind of got me up again. Mm. And then they put me in a wheelchair, and like I remember my friends just helped me saying, Brona, I couldn't feel anything. I couldn't feel them hitting me or nothing, just completely numb. Like
my main memory at that time is just this complete numbness, and almost like, do you know that feeling when you're about to faint?
Yeah.
And the sound kind of all goes fuzzy.
Yeah.
And goes kind of like a ringing in your ears. And I remember just saying, like, what's her mommy going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the big thought that I had. Yeah. Was her wee mommy,
yeah.
who relied on Lyra so much, even though she'd moved to Derry, she split her week.
Oh,
so half her week was still spent with her mommy. And I just, like, that was just completely in. I just couldn't. I couldn't focus on anything bar the fact that her mommy was losing her baby, her youngest child. And, and then I remember one of the girls I was friends with at the time. She sat with me. They all sat with me. And then she said to me, "Sarah, her mommy's coming. You need to go and wash up."
Yeah.
Because I was still sitting.
You're,
you know, my hands were coated. It was all down my face. Weirdly, it was nowhere on my clothes.
Yeah.
I don't understand how, but it was nowhere on my clothes.
Yeah.
So she took me up to the top of the corridor, and there's like a disabled toilet up there, and she took me in and she washed my face and my hands for me.
Yeah.
And I just stood there and let her. I couldn't. And that guilt had been building in me, and I was just like, what if?
Yeah.
And that's always the thing. You can't help it. You know, like, nothing I did could have changed anything.
No.
Apart from maybe if I had stood where she was standing and I'd have been hit. That's really the only difference that I could have made that night. Because whether I went or not, Lyra was going to be there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She wanted to go. But I could just feel this like really intense pressure building on me. And I was like, I need to scream.
Yeah.
I need to go and scream somewhere. So they were like, just scream. And I was like, no. Because they work in the hospital. I was like, no, the stroke ward's there.
Yeah.
I need to go over here somewhere that's far enough away. Because it's one of those things. I think regardless, when you work with people and you work in a place, you know that you wouldn't want to disturb people that are already dealing with a lot. So I went over onto the helicopter pad and just stood at the edge of it and screamed and screamed and screamed and screamed. Because I didn't know how I was going to face her family.
No, and you knew that your life was about to change forever too as well. Do you know?
Obviously, honestly, didn't realise just how much it was going to change. I think, you know, I'd lost my daddy, I'd lost my mommy.
Yeah.
I know what loss is. I know what it's like to lose somebody in the aftermath and how hard it is.
What way has it impacted on your life?
Oh, it's changed everything.
Yeah.
Like, nothing is the same anymore.
Yeah.
Which I knew after it, like, because we'd been building a new life together.
Absolutely.
And we had all our plans. And you know yourself, you have your plans.
You do, You have your like 3 to 4 year, 5 year plans. You know, everybody does it. Every couple does it, yeah.
And we had our plans and we had everything all laid out for us. And we, you know, kind of, we knew there was going to be a lot of pressure on us for a while because Lyra was deep in the middle of this book that she was writing about young boys that had gone missing in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And there was a lot of pressure on her to write that. So it was like, right, here's how we're going to get through this bit.
Yeah.
And then suddenly all that was gone.
Yeah.
You know? And also she died in the place that I worked.
Yeah.
So that was a massive thing.
Yeah.
She
Did you ever, I know you were saying you have the long COVID and stuff. Mm-hmm. Have you ever returned, have you ever been back and Elton? Working as in just back in
again? Oh no, I went back to work and everything. I had to. I couldn't afford not to. Because, I mean, the reality is, and I'm sure you know that yourself, you go from having, I mean, Lyra didn't live with me for massively long, but we...
We had two people on income.
And we were living, we had two people on income.
Yeah.
And when you go from that back to a single person income, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
So there was no option. I did have to go back to work eventually.
Yeah.
So Lyra was killed in April and I went back in the September.
Okay.
But I mean, for that, it really impacted on me because I couldn't drive into work the way that we had driven in that night.
Yeah.
Every time I drove past that Glen Chain Road entrance onto Elton the Galvin, I took massive panic attacks.
Yeah.
It was really extreme. Yeah. Like, so I had to drive in through the back entrance.
Yeah.
I couldn't go back. I didn't go back to the job that I've been doing previously because that was in the main building and I couldn't face the main building.
Yeah.
But I thankfully had got a secondment.
Yeah.
And I was working in a different sectional hospital, which is outside. It's a wee place called Seatrick that does medical research.
Yeah.
Fantastic facility, really state of the art. So I got a job working in there.
Yeah.
And it was nice because I came back into an area where I hadn't worked with anybody who was in there.
Yeah.
So nobody knew me apart from there's that girl that was on the news.
Yeah.
But every time I ventured into the main hospital, because my job took me everywhere.
Yeah.
People know me from every ward. Yeah. So you would, like a 10-minute walk up to the shop would take an hour because you'd be stopped so much because people are so good.
Yeah.
You know.
Do you find that difficult being such in the public eye now but that you know, you probably weren't beforehand, you know?
Aye. No, I mean, it was so difficult at the start.
Yeah.
It took a wee bit of time to get used to it because, you know, you'd have people who... You know they know who you are because you saw them every day at work, but they might never have spoken to you before.
Yeah.
Or you saw them every day in the street, but they might never have spoken to you before.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you were kind of like this public property, so they would speak to you and they would ask intrusive questions.
Yeah.
And you could always tell the people, there were so many people, most of them meant genuinely meant good. And then there was the odd one who you knew didn't.
I wanted the bars of the week.
I wanted to be able to say, I was talking to her and I heard this. But the vast majority of people are just coming from a really genuine place and a really good hearted place.
Yeah.
And I think it's a market dairy person that we would talk to Nick the Devil anyway. So
definitely.
You know, I would never not talk to somebody. Yeah. And that's sometimes been to my detriment where I would put myself in a place that ends up being quite uncomfortable or.
Yeah. And did you find any comfort in, you know?
100%. Yeah. I think the thing is, I'm in a really, really, really privileged position.
Okay.
Because Lyra was known, she was part of the journalistic community of Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
Aside from that, because of the work that she did, she knew everybody.
Yeah.
Like, she knew everybody. And she was friends with people across all religions, across...
Amazing.
All paramilitary groups.
Yeah.
You know, she really did. She had so many friends. So I know that put me in a really privileged position where actually my... loss got a lot more news time than other people's did.
Yeah.
And that's it's really sad.
Yeah.
You know, because through the course of this and through the course of even just knowing Lyra, I've heard stories that I had never heard before.
Yeah.
That deserve the same level of recognition. They deserve the same level of notice to be taken.
Yeah.
And some of them happened 40 years ago and they were just a piece in the paper.
Brushed over, yeah.
A piece in the paper and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
So I recognise the fact that, like, I've had a lot more attention on my loss than a lot of people have had on theirs.
Yeah.
And I recognise the fact that that's really bloody unfair.
Yeah, 100%.
But that's why I do try to make time to listen when somebody comes to me and talks to me about their experience.
Yeah.
Because everybody deserves to be heard and everybody's loss. It doesn't matter if it's somebody being, if it's your partner being shot by a paramilitary group. It doesn't matter if it's a sudden loss to a health issue. It doesn't matter how it happens. It still affects people.
Absolutely. Loss is a loss.
No loss is any more worthy than any other. And that's a thing that I think we find really difficult to process is the fact that, you know, my loss and your loss are very different.
Yeah.
Doesn't make my loss or your loss any more worthy.
No, definitely.
Both of us have suffered off the back of losing loss. People. Yeah. And I mean, you know, would I go through a loss like Lyra's again tomorrow? God, no.
No.
Losing people naturally is still really bloody hard, but it's the aftermath of it that I think is different.
It's the impact of the, afterwards. And how, it's how do you readjust your life again?
Aye.
Do you know, but even life it, after loss is pretty difficult.
It really is. And I mean, then whenever you have life after loss plus scrutiny on top of it, that's the difficult thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas like when I lost my daddy, it was really hard. You know, he was, he had been sick for a while, but he was 82.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was his time. He was happy to go by the end of it. And it was hard afterwards. You know, it was an other adjustment period, but there was nobody scrutinizing me.
No.
And there was nobody asking me to do anything. It was basically get yourself back on the horse.
Yeah.
Get yourself ready to come back to work and get back into a life where you don't have an 82-year-old man to look after.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's an easier adjustment than whenever it's like, right, Sarah, we've got somebody coming from ITV today and we need you to do this. And then you've got court and you need to be aware that they're outside the court and, you know, there's a big crowd of them and like you're going to have to face down that gauntlet of these people who support the man who's accused of, you know, being part of your partner's murder.
Yeah.
You know, that is a side of things that I think in Northern Ireland we forget about with victims.
Absolutely.
That they're having to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think also the fact that because we're quite good at being like stuff up our lip and all the rest of it, people are kind of just expected to get back on the horse and get on with it.
Just get on with it.
Whereas like I haven't met anybody who's lost somebody as a result of violence who isn't massively mentally scarred by it.
Yeah.
You know?
And did you go through any like bereavement counselling or any services afterwards? Or?
I've been working with Wave.
Oh, yeah.
Wave Trauma, who've been amazing. They've been really, really good to me. If I'm honest, the NHS has been a dead loss.
Same with me.
I went to the doctors and it was the July after Lyra had been killed and I was trying everything to keep my head straight. So I was going to the gym and I was trying to eat healthily, but my mental health was shot. I was spending all night just with panic attacks, massive panic attacks throughout the whole night, thinking I was having a heart attack, feeling like I was dying. And I went to the doctors and I saw a locum and I explained the situation to him and he didn't look me in the eye once during it. And at the end of it, he went, well, you're very overweight, so I'm going to prescribe you exercise. And I was like, I'm doing exercise. I'm going to the gym 3 times a week.
Yeah.
It's not exercise I need.
Yeah.
It's like, I need medical intervention. And he went, we'll try exercise first. And I was like, right, okay. So, you know, that was kind of what I was up against.
Aye.
And the difficulty, you know yourself, the difficulty nowadays in getting the doctor's appointment.
Yeah.
I mean, that was 2019. It's only gotten worse since then.
It's 10 times worse now.
And then it took a year before I got prescribed medication.
Yeah.
You know, and like there's no stigma with me about medication.
If
you can't produce your own serotonin, shop bought is perfectly fine.
Exactly. You know,
do whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
And that was a hard
I think
year.
Anybody who goes through a really traumatic loss or a loss in itself, that they, if they don't go down the medication route, they are considering it. You know, I was on medication as well for 18 months. I could have not have done it without it.
No.
Do you know, it just wasn't even an option.
That's it.
Do you know?
It's so necessary because it's a thing, you don't know when it's going to hit you and it's the weirdest thing set you off sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
So,
and that's it, and 100%, like it is, it's the smallest things now that, you know, you're nearly, what, four years on now in
years,
April?
Next month.
And I'll be 3 now in April too as well, but this is it, and it's just you're learning to adjust and to adapt it all to as well. And then as I said, because yours is still, the case is still ongoing too, it's probably even more difficult for you.
Aye. Well, I mean, it's one of those weird things. Like COVID kind of put it to bed for a wee while.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, as much as it was awful and a complete horror show, in that respect, it was brilliant for me.
Yeah.
Because we got to the first anniversary and COVID was there.
Yeah.
So there wasn't that attention on it.
No.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
And I was really glad for everybody because I think it just gave us all a chance to breathe. And actually, it was probably when I started grieving.
Yeah.
You know, I hadn't.
I had to kind of process it.
I hadn't been able to up until that point because I was too busy.
Yeah.
You know, I was constantly on the go. My adrenaline was up all the time. It's little wonder I was having anxiety attacks all night, every night, because I think I was just like flooded with cortisol constantly.
Yeah.
And then it all stopped and it was a learning curve. So I didn't do any counselling until COVID.
Yeah.
because it was too early. There's no point doing it too early afterwards, no. Because you're just, your brain hasn't had time to
No, that's it. And then you probably would go back to it anyway if you did it too early.
That's it.
You
know? That's it. And I mean, I know I still, there's definitely more to be processed, because actually the counselling that I did, we didn't even really address Lyra. It was all other things that kind of were off the back of the situation.
Yeah.
But it wasn't actually to do with the loss, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Did you find that your friends and family were really kind of sense of comfort and support to you?
100%. I mean, my sister...
They probably still are continued to know.
100%. Yeah. My sister and her fella, they moved in with me pretty much straight after it.
Oh my God, brilliant.
Which was both a blessing and a curse. It's, you know, whenever you're not used to living with somebody, like me and my sister hadn't properly lived together since 1986.
Yeah, so, right, okay, it was a huge adjustment.
It was a big adjustment. And then her fella, is, he's not from Derry, he's from Coleraine, and he's Protestant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Coleraine was, they had, I think, one major, like, bombing during the Troubles, and then the rest of it was quite quiet. So he'd never experienced anything like this before. So it was kind of like you were counselling him.
Yeah.
About his fear, about what had happened, and about, because him and Lyra got on really well. They were really, we used to say that he was Lyra with a woolly, basically, because the two of them had the same personality. So it was, you know, there was a lot of, we were all processing trauma together.
Yeah.
And I think that's another side of it that makes it difficult, because we all do it differently. We all handle things in different ways. So between the three of us, and then everybody else who was kind of coming in or around COVID, coming to the garden, we were all processing it kind of together.
Together, yeah. And that's, you know, and I probably, you know, probably was a blessing too, that the fact that it was COVID and you sit around the garden and talk, where life be so busy at times that that's you don't get a chance to see each other as often, do you know, I suppose?
That's it. I mean, and everybody, you know, it's a thing. I was, my life kind of stopped.
Yeah.
So I wasn't working, but I work for the NHS. So they're very good whenever you're off. So I had like 6 months full pay, 6 months half pay, and was able to kind of function on that. But not everybody would have had that.
No, you know, definitely not.
People have to go back to their work. They have to get back into the swing of things. So where your life can somewhat stop, not everybody around you can.
Yeah.
You know, and it's and then yours has to go back at some
absolutely. Point. How are you coping now? After, you know, how is life now after nearly 4 years on? Is there a lot changed now?
A lot's changed. I think, like, it had to.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it couldn't stay the same. Everything in my life changed.
Yeah.
After Lyra was killed, like, I couldn't go back to the same job. A while after it, I lost a lot of the friends that I had at that time, people who I thought were like my best friends turned out really not to be.
Okay.
And that was a blow as well.
Yeah.
You know, and family situations fluctuated, you know, issues. Everybody's dealing with their grief, and Lyra's family and I had really tough times.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody needs somebody to blame when it happens, you know, we didn't have somebody. We didn't have a figurehead.
Yeah.
So naturally a lot of it fell on me, and, you know, I understood it then, I understand it now. You know, it's just how it works. And there was all of that. So it was a really, really tumultuous.
Yeah.
Probably 2.5 years after Lyra was killed, where you're having to come together for court things whenever they happened, and then having to kind of come apart again, and you're dealing with your grief.
You have to kind of put that face in front on.
You do, because at the end of the day, unity is the most important thing, particularly in the face of something like, you know, going to court.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be a united front.
100%, because she's want justice for Lyra.
That's it. And Lyra was the most important thing at the end of it. Like, that's what it had to always boil down to.
Yeah.
Like, getting justice for her, whatever that's going to look like, is the most important thing. So it was a lot, you know, a lot of, like, life changes. Everything kind of went up in the air. I had to really look at who I was and what I wanted from my life, and then look at everything has changed. The life that I thought I was going to live, I'm not living anymore.
Yeah.
So what life am I going to live now? You know.
And was that, I get what you mean. You know, you have to find that kind of self worth in yourself, that, you know, you lose your identity there and then.
100%.
And then you have to readjust and do a brand new life. Do you know, it's really on top of it. You know, mine's was public to a certain level because mine was through COVID and, you know, but then I made myself more public because I spoke very openly and honestly about it on Instagram. And then that's how it kind of, this all kind of.
And I remember seeing your posts, you know, and I remember like looking at the pictures of your wains and just thinking, oh my God, how's that girl even doing this?
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't have imagined dealing with a loss and having children.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then having you have to be their parents.
Yeah, 100%.
You have to be there for them doubly.
Yeah.
And then deal with your own grief as well. You know, I mean, I think it's one of the things that I've really noticed through this, and I don't know if everybody feels this way, but no matter how bad your own thing is, you'll see somebody else that'll have a loss.
Yeah.
And you'll look at them and be like, well, thank God.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not dealing with what they're having to deal with.
Yeah, 100%.
And that's a thing that has actually made me think, well, do you know what? Like, maybe you're dealing with it better than you thought, because you're looking at somebody else and you're thinking, well, Jesus, they have it a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, and there's people that tell me, but mine wasn't as bad as yours. And I'm like, I'd rather have been dealing with mine without the added benefit or the added stress of like three kids or
100%.
You know, a mortgage or whatever. Yeah. Like, it's really stupid in some ways when you think about it, but in other ways it does kind of make you feel, right, well, you know, you're not at the rock bottom, because you're still looking at other people and saying they have it worse than I do.
100%. And I think too as well, you just, you know, when you are in the pits of your own grief, and you know, strangely enough, you seem to just get this overwhelming power to just kind of fight back and go from strength to strength to strength. You know, grief can be I seen a quote the other day on Instagram, and I says that is bang on. Grief is the most nastiest game ever, but it also makes you the most strongest person you ever have to become, because you've got no other choice.
That's it. You've no option. You have to. And it's either, well, I mean, you don't have to, I suppose. Your options are, you either wallow in it.
Yeah.
Or you come out fighting.
Yeah.
And for me, it was, I had to come out fighting. Yeah. I had no other option, because it's what Lyra would have done for me.
Exactly.
You know, and like, the other side of it is, like, you see the person you love being co-opted by other people.
Yeah.
And them being used, their name or their likeness or whatever, being used by other people in ways that they would hate.
Yeah.
And that was a big driver for me as well, because I was like, Lyra would be rolling.
Yeah.
Like, she'd be spinning in her grave.
Yeah.
So that was a thing of making sure that she was represented properly.
Yeah.
You know, and that people wouldn't get the wrong idea about her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know, It's a really weird thing, just because it was so public.
Yeah.
You know yourself, like, because it's so public, you have everybody talking about you.
Yeah.
You have people sharing stuff, and sometimes you can't help but go looking at what's being shared and see what people are saying. And then you have to deal with the aftermath of that as well.
But then the thing is that, and I get that 100%, and you know, that, you know, we all go through that too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the things that's been said online are, you know, are the most nasty things that people could say, when, you know, really, when it boils down to it all, when you're sitting in them four walls at night time on your own in the pits of it, nobody else is there to pick up the pieces. Nobody else is there to support you, because you don't have that significant dollar anymore.
That person,
they don't see it like that.
No.
Do you know?
And maybe they've never experienced it, or maybe they have experienced it, and they're just bitter because they haven't maybe had the same recognition or notice taken of their loss. And that's kind of the way that I've chosen to look at it. It's like, do you know what?
It is what it is.
I feel more sorry for them.
Yeah.
Because maybe they just don't know what it is. They love somebody that much.
Yeah.
And maybe they've never lost anybody. And I mean, that's great for them. But at some point they will lose somebody.
100%. And you know what you had. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
That's,
do you know, that'll never change no matter what. Aye. You know.
And that's a big thing. You know, it's whenever you love somebody that much and you are building this life together and you have all these plans, and that's snatched away, the potential never goes anywhere. That potential just sits there.
Yeah.
And it's always in the back of your mind of what could have been.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think that's the thing. You're mourning that as well as the loss of the person.
Absolutely.
You know, and you have to get it out there. And we do have a lot more public ways of putting stuff out there now than we would have had previously.
Yeah.
You know, I spoke to people who've lost their partner, say, in the 70s and the 80s, and, you know, some of them never moved on. But they also, their grief was never expressed publicly.
Yeah.
And they made, I mean, I chatted to Pat Finucane's wife, and she said that she actually made a point of never publicly expressing that grief.
Yeah.
And she was like, you know, that isn't for public consumption, that's for private. And I was like, I get that.
I get it too, yeah.
I totally get that. And there, obviously, I mean, there are things for me that are for private as well. But I think in this day and age, you do, if you want people to be thinking more deeply about it, you have to be a bit more vulnerable and put it out there. And I've done that sometimes. I haven't done it massive amounts.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important for people to see that just because somebody dies, they don't just disappear.
Yeah.
And the love that you have for them doesn't just disappear. 100%. It's always going to be there.
This is it. You're always going to carry it. Do you know what I mean? No matter what, whatever way life goes, do you know, like I'm the exact same, do you know, no matter what way my life now becomes, do you know, I will always carry, you know, I'll always carry Berkey and my daddy and Gorbo, like, in my heart always. Aye. Do you know what I mean? Because one thing I can't, you know, is just the, you know, Berkey was the father to my children. Mm-hmm. So that's never going to, you
got,
know.
You've got loving reminders there all the time. 100%. Which is a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have memories of their daddy, and you always want that to stay there. And I think that's a really, it's a really special thing.
Yeah,
they have
100%.
You know, and I think, like, I don't know, no matter what way your life goes, you know, you can never plot it out.
No, even, you can't.
You can make plans, but you never, you're never guaranteed. But I think having those memories and having that person to say, "Oh, I remember the time that we did this.
Yeah,
we went there," or you know,
yeah.
And then sometimes you have to go back to that place and you make a new memory with somebody else.
Yeah.
And it's bittersweet.
Yeah.
But it's all part of loving.
Yeah,
100%. You know, it's part of keeping them with you, because I think when you go back to a place that you've been to with this person who was so special to you and you loved so much, and now maybe you've met somebody and you've moved on and you go there with that person, it doesn't take away from the memory that you made with the person before.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a continuation. And the fact is, like, if somebody means enough to you, mm-hmm. you're taking them to a place that was special to you and that person.
Yeah.
And it continues your story, and they're always going to be there in the background.
100%. Definitely. Mm. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, that love will always be there forever, no matter what.
Exactly. And I mean, it's, I don't know, until you've lost a partner.
Yeah.
It's different, because with your parents, it's always expected. You know what I mean? Yeah. You'll always miss your mommy. You'll always miss your daddy. With a partner, you just never know what way it's going to be. And I've known lots of people lose their partners and seen, you know, the aftermath of it. I mean, I saw my daddy after my mommy died.
Yeah.
And he went, my daddy had actually lost two wives. So his first wife, she died quite young.
Okay.
She had a heart condition. She died when my big brother was 7.
Okay.
And he went to pieces then.
Yeah.
And then when my mommy died, same thing. He just went absolutely to pieces, and he wanted to die with her.
Yeah.
You know? Until he took a heart attack a year later, and then he didn't want to die anymore.
Oh God, almighty.
It taught him that actually he didn't want to be gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that aftermath, you know, of what way will your life be?
Yeah.
For my daddy, he never wanted to move on again.
Yeah.
He had stayed single for a long time after his first wife died.
Mm-hmm.
And then he met my mommy, and they'd known each other for years anyway. So it was kind of natural for them to end up going out. And then after she died, he was in his late 60s, and I was like, "Daddy, you're still young."
Yeah.
He's like, "No, there's nobody for me but your mommy."
No.
And that was him to the day he died. He never ever looked at anybody else.
Yeah.
Whereas I've known other people who've moved on really, really quickly.
Yeah.
Within a year of their partner dying. Yeah. And it was the right thing for them. Yeah. And it was good for them.
Yeah.
But the aftermath with their families was horrific.
Yeah.
100%. You know? And it's,
I suppose it's adjustment for everybody too, as well.
It is.
Definitely.
It's all about, like, mourning and just, like, adjusting your grief to match the circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of, I don't know, sometimes I think you kind of put it in a box for a wee while.
Yeah.
When you need to.
Yeah.
But it doesn't stay in it for too long.
No, definitely not. Definitely. What's your hopes now for 2023?
Well, I'm kind of at the stage where 2023 where we're looking at this case going to court properly.
Yeah.
So hopefully. There's never any guarantees. We thought we were thinking 2023. It might actually push on to 2024. But we've got that. So that's going to be a difficult thing, because that brings it all back up again.
Yeah.
And because it's going to go to proper trial, it'll be even harder because there's lots of footage from that day, and then there'll be forensic reports and things like that. Yeah. So not massively looking forward to that. And that is kind of putting a bit of a strangle on being massively hopeful for 2023.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I don't know really, to be fair. I kind of have spent every year for the last 4 years in a bit of a limbo.
Yeah, kind of what?
Because you just don't know where things are going.
No.
At the minute, like, we're doing a bit of, I'm doing wee bits and pieces around, there was a film actually made about Lyra.
Yeah, it's in it, yeah.
By one of her best friends. And so that's doing a bit of traveling at the minute.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm in Portrush and Port Stewart this week.
Oh, very good.
Doing Q&As after it. And then it's going to a lesbian film festival in England.
Brilliant.
At the end of the month. So going over for that. So that should be good. So
and I suppose that gives you great, you know, it must give you a great sense of comfort knowing that, you know, that Lyra's passed, but you're still, you know, you're still doing good for her, do you know?
Well, I think that's the big thing.
She'd be so proud of you, like.
She, do you know what? She actually would. And it's one of them weird things when, you know, you don't like saying, she would be proud of me.
No, she would.
But she would, because when she was alive, like, I was always, like, you know, helping her with stuff. Whenever she was writing her book, I had a proofread and gone through, and I did bits of research for her and stuff. And she was like, you know, you shouldn't just be working in the hospital. You should be doing something else. And I was like, I don't want to do anything else.
No.
I'm happy doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
She was like, but you could public speak. You could. I was like, I don't want to.
No.
I don't want to do it. I hate public speaking. It's my hell.
Yeah.
And I've had to do so much of it over the last 3.5-4 years. Yeah. And it's bloody awful.
Yeah.
So she would be really, really pleased actually seeing that I'm speaking using my voice,
yeah,
and not just like sitting in the background putting out the odd tweet.
Yeah.
Being a Twitter troll.
Yeah.
She would be really proud, but I think she'd be really proud of the film that Alison's made.
Yeah.
Like, it's a brilliant film and it really puts Lyra across.
Yeah.
You do get to know her watching the film.
Yeah.
And because she tells her own story through it,
mm-hmm,
it's so nice hearing her voice.
Yeah.
Even 1.5 hours.
Of it. Yeah.
Of her talking.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that's going to make up a bit of it as well, where we're going to be kind of taking that out and showing it to people. We want to take it around schools.
Yeah.
Which I think is really important, because I think one of the problems that we have here is we've no government again.
Yeah.
There's a limbo, and that allows these people with extremist views to take hold of kids.
Yeah.
You know, there's no money going on to youth services, so children are kind of left to do their own devices.
Yeah.
And they're selling the Troubles like some kind of a fantastic, you know, fighting for Ireland kind of thing. Whereas actually it wasn't, you know, even then a lot of what was happening was horrific.
Yeah.
And it was leaving people in absolute despair.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's still happening now.
In this day and age.
It, you know, when actually, like, things are pretty bad at the minute in terms of the cost of living and all the rest, but we're still not in 70s.
No.
We're not in 70s deprivation at the minute.
No.
You know, we're not quite there. So I think it's good for people, I think, to see, you know, how bad it has been and how it's continued to be bad.
Yeah.
And maybe just, like, lead them away from the idea that it's all exciting.
No. It's unpacked for it afterwards and stuff, yeah.
And I think if you haven't been through it, because most people haven't, most people aren't loving that anymore,
no,
then it's very easy for it all to seem exciting.
Yeah.
Until you realise that there's real people on the other end.
Yeah.
Who are going to be affected by it. And, you know, one of my big things, all the things that I've done, like, I'm involved with the John and Pat Hume Foundation.
Amazing.
And my big push with that, again, is for youth.
Yeah.
You know, empowering our young people, because I don't think we've done that enough here.
No, 100%. And they're the next stage too as well, to be brought up, you know, through it all. And, you
that's
know.
That's it.
Definitely. It's amazing. Like.
And, like, I always said, like, I did politics at school and, like, I did debate and stuff at St. Cecilia's. But for me, I don't think there was ever a time when it was kind of pushed forward that actually you have a voice and your voice matters and you can be involved in politics and you can be involved in shaping things. And I think that's what kids need. They need to be told that actually they're really important.
Yeah, 100%.
And regardless of whether they're sitting doing four A levels and looking at going to Oxford, or they're looking at doing an apprenticeship, or they're going to end up in the dole.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
No, 100%.
You still have a voice. You still matter.
Yeah.
And you can make a difference. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's the thing. It's about like helping to identify young leaders.
Yeah.
Within their communities. And that's, I think a lot of the time, in my opinion, our young leaders tend to be like very middle class.
Yeah.
They come from more affluent areas. Mm-hmm. And actually there's kids sitting, you know, in council houses who yeah. are fantastic and really deserve a chance and a voice.
Absolutely.
And sometimes it's really hard for them to access that.
Yeah.
So for me, that's my big push. It's about empowering young people.
Amazing. Yeah.
In as many ways as is possible.
Yeah.
Because like you said, they are the future.
Absolutely, you know, they are.
I mean, our generation is, I mean, I'm sure you're a good bit younger than me, but our generation is kind of where the change, I think, is starting.
Yeah.
You know, like sort of people in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
Who have been sort of more open to being friends with people from across the divide and
yeah.
maybe gone to more integrated schools. So I think now it's...
100%. Like, I'm 32 and I went to Oak Grove. I actually went to Oak Grove Primary and Oak Grove Integrated. And I can hand on heart say this. See, I was maybe about 14 or 15 and I actually knew what a Catholic and a Protestant was in. I was never spoke about in Oak Grove, ever.
Which I think, like, that's what I think it should be like.
Yeah.
You know, I think, because realistically, religion isn't the big deal.
No.
You know, and most of us don't even go to church anymore.
No, definitely not.
But you'll still identify as a Catholic or a Protestant.
Yeah.
But, like, for me growing up, like, where I grew up, until I was six, I lived in Belmont.
Yeah.
Belmont's a really mixed estate and it was never ever a thing that I ever thought about.
Yeah.
And I had mixed family and stuff, so it was never an issue. And then I moved from Belmont to Bishop Street and I got my eyes opened at 6 years old and I learned about all this stuff that I had never known about before.
Yeah.
And I think I'd much preferred to have continued being willfully ignorant about it.
Yeah.
You know, and because I do think, like, my sister's kids hadn't a clue.
Yeah.
Hadn't one notion about religion, hadn't a notion about politics, didn't know they were Catholic.
No.
Weren't really aware. They knew they did religion at school, but they didn't know exactly what that meant. And I just think that would be so much better for our kids if they just were, you know, all put together.
Yeah.
Integration is the key.
Absolutely.
You know, I think if we don't bring people together, both in school and in living.
Yeah.
We all live in different areas. I mean, you have some areas that are going to be mixed.
Yeah.
The vast majority of places in this town, that's a Catholic area, that's a Protestant area.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's little wonder there's a fear of the other.
Of it.
If you're not actually exposed to it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the big thing I think I would love to see.
Yeah.
Integrated schools is a massive, massive thing. Because as you said, like, those kids just don't think about it.
They don't at all. Like,
it's not as.
And what? Well, just our kind of last question now on it. Just so the anniversary now is coming up now on the 18th. Is it 18th of April? Mine's is the 23rd of April. Mm-hmm. What do you do to kind of, you know, self care wise? What do you do to kind of make sure that Sarah's okay?
Aye.
Lead up to the anniversary.
Usually spend a lot of time with my people.
Yeah.
So family and friends come around.
Were you good with that at the start? Did you always like to have people around you? Because I was the absolute opposite.
Not to the degree that I ended up with them. I'm quite a loner. I like my own company.
Yeah.
I enjoy spending time on my own. And I am more than happy sitting in the house with nobody.
Yeah.
So for the time after Lyra was killed, my house never emptied.
Yeah.
And it was stressful.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a hard adjustment.
And you're like, and I'm a messy bitch. Like, my house is always like turned up. So then you're having to like, right, we need to make sure that there's milk in, because I don't drink milk.
No.
And I don't drink tea and coffee. So there's never milk in my house.
Yeah.
I have to make sure there's milk in. I have to make sure there's biscuits in for people if they're coming. You know, all this stuff that just like, I would normally be like, don't have any biscuits in the house because you're already a fat midden. You don't need any more opportunity to be fatter. So it's all these things that you had to think about. And then when people left, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh my God, that has been like a solid week of 5, 6, 7 people in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And just,
it's a mask. And honestly, God, it's a mask. You put on one mask for everybody else, and you take a mask off at nighttime, and you're a completely different person.
That's it. And the thing about it is, when you're wearing that mask all the time, there are only going to be particular people who are going to see you without it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then sometimes you're just horrific to them because, yeah. you know, that mask has had to come off and they are the nearest person there and you take out your frustration.
Absolutely.
And your grief and all the rest of it on them. So that was really difficult. Like, thank God my sister has a thick skin and is more than able to take and give it.
Yeah.
So I didn't get away with anything. And we actually managed never to have a proper fight or anything when yeah. we were living together. But there was a couple of times when I probably was yeah. like really sharp or, you know, really withdrawn and just like ticked in my bed or whatever.
Yeah.
Last year, prior to the anniversary, I think I knew on the anniversary there was a few things happening in Derry.
Okay.
And Lyra's family came up from Belfast. So we spent it together for the first time, obviously post-COVID.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And we were able to do things together. And then I actually went down to Belfast after it on the night and met up with all Lyra's best friends.
Oh, amazing.
And we went for a few drinks yeah. and just talked about her and remembered her. And me and my sister went and stayed in the Grand Central Hotel and we treated ourselves to just a really nice...
Chilled out time.
Like, yeah. we were back early and things like that. Yeah. And at that time last year, I had COVID at Christmas and woke up a couple of days after I tested positive and couldn't walk, couldn't get out of bed. So I was only just sort of up and walking again at that stage in April. So I was fit for nothing,
yeah.
to be fair.
Yeah.
I had a TENS machine running all the time.
Oh no.
So this year, I don't actually know. Honestly, I mean, I tend not to plan anything for it.
Yeah.
I'll usually go and lay flowers.
Yeah.
At the place where she was killed, which is, it's weird because
bittersweet. Yeah.
It's bittersweet, but at the same time, when I go there during the day, I don't recognize it because it doesn't look the same.
Yeah.
And it's a symbolic thing, but I don't think it's symbolic for me.
Okay, yeah.
I think it's more just symbolic for other people.
Yeah.
From like, I'm doing it to make sure that people know that I'm not forgetting her.
Yeah.
But I'd rather do something like go for a walk on the beach.
Yeah.
You know, we would have went to the beach all the time and had danders across the beach. So mm-hmm. I think maybe this year, because we have nothing planned, I think that's what I might do.
Yeah.
Take myself to the beach where we would have went for walks all the time.
Yeah. Just remember her that way.
Yeah, and then 100%. Maybe if I'm up around Belfast, I'll go and lay flowers on her grave.
Yeah.
But I think, like, for me, I'm not a grave person. I never have been.
Yeah.
I'm very much I'd rather remember ye in the places we went and the things that we did.
And pictures and videos and all
that's
that.
It.
Yeah.
That's it. And that is really, really special.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on. Honest to God, it was, you know, you're doing her so much justice. And, you know, it's just amazing what you're doing now, nearly 4 years mm-hmm. on. It's remarkable what she's doing. And, you know, hopefully someday soon that she will get that justice that you deserve to have.
Fingers crossed. I mean, God knows. You never know what the outcome's going to be. But we'll see what happens. Just have to trust the process.
Aye, 100%. Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you.